Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Washington podcast with your host, Vincent Cavallari.
Sink these shoes, quit clocking down some dead end street. Take these shoes and make them fit.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Mill Creek View podcast. I'm your host, Mill Creek City Councilmember Vincent Cavallari, and this is the Mill Creek View podcast, Washington edition. As always, we are incredibly excited to have you with us. We're going to bring you a powerful show as we usually do, but we invite you to check us out at mcview.us, and we ask that you subscribe. Please do subscribe, like us, comment, leave us messages, write us, send up a smoke signal, whatever you choose. We'd love to hear from you, but do subscribe. That's your part. That's the expectation here. And of course, we do promise to make this a valuable use of your time. Also, in keeping with that same promise, it's our mission to bring you great guests. Guests with their fingers on the pulse of your community, people you want to hear from, and people you certainly need to hear from. And tonight's guest is no different. Dr. Raul Garcia will be joining us, and he is a candidate for the United States Senate. And we are, of course, excited to have him, and we'll get him on in just a few moments. And remember, here at the Mill Creek View podcast, our mission is simple: to always endeavor to make this a place where dialogue and debate will thrive and survive, and the truth will always have a home. And that is my eternal pledge to all of you. Friends, it should be obvious to everyone that the status quo in D.C. is simply not working for the American people. Our founding fathers envisioned a government of citizen legislators whom would serve every few years and then, of course, return home to their families. Certainly not a government run by a small group of special interest groups or lifelong permanently entrenched politicians that prey upon the brokenness of D.C. Many ideas have been kicked around these last few years on how to resolve this and how to wrangle in D.C., but none would ever have a significant impact as term limits would. Term limits would bring accountability that's long overdue. It would allow for checks and balances and force every legislator to debate and compromise on all the issues. You know, like the founders intended. But most importantly, it would halt the process of political entrenchment. And let me give you a quick example. Here in Washington State, Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, they've held those seats in the Senate for a combined 50-plus years. And in all that time, not one single significant piece of legislation has emanated from their office. Not one. How the hell is that even possible? They're what we call the Democrat seat fillers, the party line voters who've become entrenched by special interest groups. Huge money from big pharma, big tech, supports all of the entrenchment. And as long as they continue to play ball with the lobbyists and, of course, toe the party line, they will continue to hijack these offices. History recounts the story of Benjamin Franklin exiting the Constitutional Convention outside Independence Hall, and he was asked a question by a woman in the crowd. She says, "Do we have a monarchy or do we have a republic?" And he responded by saying that you have a republic if you can keep it. So that's my question to the electorate. Can you keep it? Can we keep it? Or have we even lost it already? Each day that passes, we learn of new abuses of speech suppression, due process violations, the weaponization of government, civil rights abuses, and dereliction of duties by these same legislators. Members of America's government confidently committing crimes against the people and the Constitution with impunity. Their arrogance stems from the belief that they can hide behind the corrupted vessel of big government. Unfortunately, they've been pretty successful thus far. Self-enrichment and self-entitlement are the elementary forms of political corruption. But friends, it's much worse than you can possibly imagine. Currently, progressives are plotting to undermine America's Constitution. They're trying to rewrite it in order to centralize party power. They're seeking to eliminate the filibuster from the United States Senate, add new states to the Union, and of course the subsequent Senate seats that would accompany statehood for territories like D.C. and Puerto Rico, and probably one of the most despicable, packing of the Supreme Court with additional justices to cement their authority. Friends, this is why a new breed of elected leader is abundantly necessary. Someone like tonight's guest. A man that's not looking for a job or confused about his career path in life. A person that's been successful in life and simply wants to pay it forward and serve his community. You know, like those same founders envisioned. America is quickly approaching that point of no return. These last 3 years have pushed us farther down the road than we could have ever possibly imagined. But I assure you, friends, they can be stopped by you, the voter. We are going to take a quick break, and when we do come back, Washington State Senate candidate Dr. Raul Garcia will be joining us, so please stay tuned. Don't go away. We will be right back. Friends, the way we grow this show is through you. If you like what you hear, please tell 10 friends, like us, share us everywhere, write us, comment, whatever you choose. Just keep on tuning in, and please do subscribe to mcview.us, and we promise to make this a valuable use of your time.
In the bank, it's all about the time we spend, those we have to thank. Thank all those good guys and gals for being such good friends. Baby, that's what it's all about, till the bitter end.
If you like what you're hearing here, you're going to love the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast, found at all your favorite podcast outlets.
It's only money, not worth the paper it's printed on. It has no warmth when you hold it in your hands.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Thanks for sticking around. I think you're going to be excited to listen to tonight's guest. He's exactly what we hoped would happen, is that the stench would reach so high that the lay public, the worker bees, would push back and do things like donate to campaigns, run for office, and really just push back on the elites. Tonight's guest, he was born in Pinar del Rio, Cuba. He was able to escape Castro's regime with his mother at the age of 11. They immigrated to Madrid, Spain, where the Catholic Church helped the two refugees obtain political asylum in the United States. The two, mom and son, settled in Miami, Florida, where most of their family continues to reside this day. He graduated from the University of Miami with a Bachelor of Science degree in microbiology and immunology. He then went to graduate school from medical school at the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine. He developed a passion for emergency medicine and has continued to serve on the front lines for at least 25 years in the emergency room. In addition to emergency medicine, he's been a successful small business owner of his own medical practice. He's also the founding dean of two medical schools and the medical director of two hospitals. He is currently the chief medical officer at Astria Toppenish Hospital. He founded Opportunity for Washington, a nonprofit, nonpartisan effort promoting education and change. He also founded the Partnership in Food Security in 2020 to promote education for COVID-19, particularly in the Latino community. He's a very proud and committed father to his five children. He and his wonderful wife, Jessica, live and reside in Yakima, Washington. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Raul Garcia. Welcome, sir. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And for the listeners, Dr. Garcia got stuck in traffic, so he was kind enough to do the right thing and pull over and not talk and drive at the same time. So we're thankful for that. How long have you been in Washington, Dr. Garcia?
I've been in Washington since 2007. The funny thing is that I came out here and I said, well, I'm going to be there a couple of years because we know that America runs on East Coast time. And got here and, of course, fell in love with the Pacific Northwest and now married a Washington gal that grew up in Ellensburg. And we have a beautiful family with five children. And this is our home and this is what we love. And this is the place that we want to make sure that we have the opportunities necessary for our children to succeed as we did.
That is actually a lot of people's story, including myself. You either visit out here, or in my case, I was stationed out here and again, fell in love with the Pacific Northwest, being outdoors. And then I met my wife and she kind of put her hooks in me and that was the end of it. I was in lockdown status till the present day. So anyhow, that's a long story for another day. Dr. Garcia, I see you've decided to upend your life and run for office. Why don't you tell us what prompted that?
Well, you know, people ask me why I want to be in politics, and I think that my goal of service has not changed. I think I'm just changing venues. I'm changing from an emergency department of one patient or one family to a state. And a country that at this moment, I think, needs change. So I worked for Senator Bob Dole back in 1990. And he became a mentor of mine and someone that really taught me what compromise was about, what bringing people to the table and finding true solutions would do for America. And I had this dream inside of me that one day I would give back to this country for everything it's done for me. And that was through public service, and just really had not found the time or the moment to say, okay, I'm gonna run for public service. And I was sitting at a campfire in 2020 with my wife in Rim Rock, not too far away from Yakima. And she turned to me and said, you know, I am tired of you talking about socialism and big government and how this doesn't work and you've experienced it. Why don't you run for governor? And I said, are you serious? He said, yes. I double dog dare you to put your money where your mouth is. And of course, I ran with the 36 other people that ran for governor in 2020. But I came into the race late. I came into the race in May, and we ran a 10-week campaign. And of course, I was so idealistic to think that we could win a statewide in 10 weeks. And we didn't, even though we picked up a lot of the big name endorsements and picked up a lot of support from communities that usually did not vote Republican, like the Latino community and the Asian community. And we found out that there was a path to changing this state and this country. My wife, who never liked politics, got into it and got into it to a point that I had to tell her some days, you know, you don't have to put all that on social media every day. So she really became a champion of change and a champion of a better opportunity for our children. So that's why we went into the nonprofit world and created organizations to promote change and promote education. To me, over-communication and education is pretty much the answer to a lot. If we understand that our job as a government is to educate, to give resources to our citizens so they could succeed, we would be in a much better place. So that is the scenario. My grandfather was mayor of a city back in Cuba, so they say that I had it in my genes. But it was really Bob Dole who made me fall in love with public service. And then, of course, I met Slay Gordon, and he became a mentor. He actually died helping us trying to win in 2020. So,
Well, you are a unique candidate for a lot of reasons. I think that growing up in Cuba and then migrating to the United States as asylum seekers, explain what that was like. What was it like growing up in Cuba as a young man?
Well, we were all forced to be communist pioneers. We were forced to talk about the imperialist Yankees and the reason why we had to suffer in Cuba, because it was because of the imperialist Yankees. And this was every day brainwash. In fourth grade, they asked us to put our heads down and ask God for candy. And candy did not appear on our desks. So then they turned and they said, okay, well, now put your heads down and ask Fidel Castro for candy. And of course, candy appeared on every desk.
Wow.
And the teachers said, this is so you learn that the only God is your government. And, well, I knew then, and for the rest of my life, I will always fight for that to never happen in this great country of ours. So I will fight big government. I have lived it. I have lived the way that they want to control the media, the education, the lives of people. I talk about brainwashing. You know, I'm Catholic, and of course, in the Catholic religion, you don't eat meat on Good Friday. Well, that was the day that Fidel Castro decided to bring meat to the supermarkets, so he could prove that he was above religion. Yeah, it was constant. It was constant. It was with everything that we lived with every day. And of course, we had the ration cards, where as a child, I would get 12 eggs a month and 1 liter of milk a week for the household, because I was a child. If I wasn't a child, the household wouldn't get eggs nor milk. We had 3 ounces of coffee per person in the household. That came from Bulgaria, because they exported the good Cuban coffee. And the rhetoric was that we needed to sacrifice so every country in the world would become communist. And if we sacrificed enough, then there would be more resources for the other countries to become communists. And that was an everyday affair in Cuba, and something, of course, of an absurd ideology that I don't follow. And probably when you go to the dictionary and look up communism, you'll see my picture as the anti-communist because of everything we lived there in Cuba.
It's classic Marxism, right? C.S. Lewis, when he wrote Man's Inevitable Rise to Godlihood, right? That's exactly what they peddle. It's exactly what they preach and teach. That's inside baseball, Doctor. That's again, I knew you had some inside perspective, so this is going to be fun to talk about. I'm going to go a little deeper. Do you see, well, you do see what's happening in here in America. That's why you're running for office. But the subtleties, anything reminiscent of communist Cuba, the happenings here in the United States present day?
Yes, of course. And this is what I would complain to my wife about, you know, the government controlling what the media says, the government controlling our education from K through 12, controlling that narrative. I mean, I think it was Nikita Khrushchev that told Kennedy, you give me a couple of generations and I will own the United States without shooting a single bullet. Right, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. And big government is about that. Big government is about more bureaucracy and more bureaucracy and more departments and more bureaucracy. And unfortunately, the lives of our everyday families is worse. You know, you want to build a house these days in our state, and you got to go through an enormous amount of bureaucracy. You want a permit. As a contractor, the same. You look at every aspect of our life and you see the government trying to put their hands in it. And I could tell everyone listening to us, it doesn't work. Government should be here to, as I said, educate and give resources to our citizens to succeed, not control their life, not tell them what to do, not force them into a corner. And we're doing that everywhere I see in our lives.
But you fled communism, you and your mom, you fled communism to seek asylum, well, first and elsewhere, but then the United States. You did it the right way, and I think that's why your message is so important. And you became a physician, a teaching physician. You've done all of this during your lifetime. 70% of Americans feel the southern border as the gravest threat to our sovereignty. Do you believe the same?
Yeah. Well, what I say is that every sovereign nation should have the right to vet everyone that comes in and out of their country. And not only are we not vetting everyone that comes in and out of our country, but we are letting an enormous amount of crime and drugs infiltrate our country. And the consequence is that our kids are dying of fentanyl in our streets. I mean, we have made fentanyl one of our main, if not the main issue of our campaign, because I want to pass the Americans Against Act to put drug dealers in jail with manslaughter charges and have involuntary rehabilitation for addicts. We need to have solutions to change this, and they have to be drastic. And the southern border and the northern border, because that is not ironclad either. It's just seen and read about a lot of incidents in the northern border where things are coming through very freely. Again, we are not only a sovereign country, but we are the best sovereign country in the world. We should have the right to vet everyone that comes in and out of our country. And do I support immigrants coming to this country? Absolutely. 100%. I think that this has always been a country of immigrants, and we should always remember that we are a country of immigrants. And anyone, as Reagan said, with a heart will to get here and succeed should. But they can't, because our legal immigration system has such a bureaucracy these days that is not the same as when I came. So if we simplify our legal immigration system, that would be a huge step in eliminating a lot of our illegal immigration in this country to begin with. So, yes, I'm a staunch supporter of more discipline and leadership at our borders, and I'm a staunch supporter of cleaning our streets, finding true solutions, and taking drastic measures.
You mentioned crime and drugs just a moment ago, and fentanyl as well, of course. As a first responder in the emergency rooms, have you ever seen anything like this scourge facing our communities now?
No, I haven't. I have said that in 25 years of service, I have not seen a killer like fentanyl. And I was in the South Bronx treating patients that were addicted to crack during that epidemic. But I have not. I mean, I have seen every single drug that there is out there, and you can imagine that in my experience, all the things that I have seen. But nowadays, just 3 days ago, I had 5 overdoses of fentanyl in one shift, right? For this President's Day weekend, I had 9 altogether. And, you know, we were lucky enough that we were 9 for 9, and we brought back 9 lives. But some of those we can't get to. And some of those die, because the thing with fentanyl is that it's so addictive that right now the person that tastes fentanyl the first time, that uses fentanyl for the first time, the statistics show that they will die within 2 years, because everything is laced now with fentanyl. And the second reason why it's so conniving is because these labs, wherever they are, whether in another country or in our own state, that we have found labs here creating this killer, They don't have a calibration system to tell you how many micrograms they're going to put in a tablet that you're going to sell in the street. So, you know, to all the listeners out there that tell me, are you against medical fentanyl? No, of course I'm not. I am talking about non-medical fentanyl. Those tablets that are non-calibrated, out-street, and one of those could have 25 micrograms to give you that high, and some of those tablets have 2 milligrams that will kill you immediately. And that's what I have seen happen in our communities. I have seen children try it for the first time and die. And this is not something that we shouldn't be completely and utterly serious about in our response.
We are currently watching from the front rows the poisoning of a generation. And I share the front row with you because I'm also a first responder with the sheriff's office. And you recently testified in front of the state legislature. Just to give some context, what percentage of the cases coming into your emergency room are fentanyl related?
Well, we see a lot a day. I would say 10% at this point. Let me back up. 10% of all the medical cases that come in every day, right? But about 95% of overdoses are fentanyl. 95% of overdoses that we see are fentanyl.
And so now when you mix that with the progressive prosecutors that have implemented this, we will not prosecute for low-level offenders approach, what message are we sending to the folks out there who are addicted? Are we even treating them in a humane manner at this point by allowing them to twist in the wind through their addiction?
No, we are letting people die in our streets. We are not a compassionate government. We are letting people die in our streets as if we saw someone trying to stab themselves or saw someone trying to drink Drano. In those cases, any human being would try to stop it. So why are we not being humane and trying to stop this killer that is going to kill that person and pulling these individuals out of the street and getting them into a six-month rehab? That's what Americans Against Fentanyl Act would do. That would include mental health, that would include counseling, and it would include businesses that would take these graduate rehab patients into the world again with a job, or tech colleges with a degree, or even universities for an education. If we build this and take these individuals out of their environment, the majority of addicts that have succeeded have come back and said to us, thank you for taking me out of that place when I couldn't make my own decisions. And I, as a physician, could tell you 100% that those brains are telling these individuals to lie, cheat, and steal to get that next fix. That is all that they're thinking. They're not thinking correctly. And if you saw someone drinking Drano, you would think that they have a mental problem that you need to help. And you would ask those people to be removed out of the environment where they could get Drano. So this is the same thing for me. I think that we need to take drastic measures and be compassionate, actually build a compassionate government that doesn't let people die in our streets.
So I think the frustrating part, again, you on the front lines in the emergency room and me in the front lines of the streets, is that we know where the components are coming from. We know where the components are being put into pill form or powders or cut down, whatever. And we know where it's being imported onto our streets. Yet the party that's in power seems to be allowing it. And it goes back to the border, in my opinion, as the large factor here. But would you support the federal government taking an expanded role? You mentioned, the Americans Against Fentanyl Act, taking an expanded role, for example, special prosecutors, mandatory minimum sentences and things of that nature to combat this head on.
Oh, yeah. I think that a drug dealer should get manslaughter charges and be put away for a long time. So when we put these addicts, these patients, these human beings in mandatory rehab, they could come back to an environment that is free of dealers. Let's put those dealers in jail. And I have talked to friends that are in the law, and they have said, well, you know, it is possible that we are going to be able to prove manslaughter, but it's completely doable that we can prove that these individuals are endangering a community, which is still a felony. It's like putting a poison in the water supply of a city. So I have, and I keep talking to friends in the law field just to make sure that when this law takes effect, we could give the power to law enforcement to arrest and prosecute these people, no questions asked.
Are the patients coming through the emergency room? And I'm sorry I'm hitting on fentanyl so much. I want to take advantage of your expertise.
Yeah, no.
Are the patients...
I have no problem with it.
Are the patients coming into your emergency room? And the reason I'll tell you why I asked this question in a moment. Are the patients getting younger and younger? I mean, I've witnessed the attempted reviving of 10-month-olds, 2-year-olds, and successful and unsuccessful both. Are they getting younger and younger?
100%. Yes. And these are grandchildren. These are children. This is insane. Let's pay attention here. Let's take drastic measures. I am an accepting person. As an emergency physician and no disrespect, I want to thank you for your service. And I say no disrespect because there was an incident in New York where I had a police officer and the criminal that shot him next to each other. And the police officer shot the criminal as well. And never in my mind was a doubt that I needed to pick one over the other. My purpose was to save both, and I did, and it was a successful story. So I am an accepting person as an emergency physician. I am going to treat everybody that comes in that door the same. And I have transcended this to my children, to be accepting of people. We're not all the same. We all have different ideologies. Let's accept people for who they are. But you can't accept things that are infringing upon our lives and our businesses and our families. And this is what this government is doing, accepting those things that infringe upon our lives and our families. And that is not acceptable.
So I'm going to stay in the emergency room here for a minute. Suicide is now the second leading cause of death among young people, with the first, of course, being poisoning or drug overdose. After a year and a half of being locked down and out of schools, children forced into wearing masks, kept away from one another, from interacting with their peers, classmates, in some cases their own families, have we permanently damaged many of these children?
That's a hard question, because I have seen a lot of mental health patients over the last 3 years. I've seen an incredible increase in the amount of younger mental health patients. But I think that we can't just sit here and say, well, we've damaged everyone, that's it. No, I think that we try, right? Because this is a family. This is what we would do for our own family. We would try and try again and try to bring up solution after solution so we could find a good outcome at the end. And that's what we have to do. We have to take this serious. We have to take mental health serious and find solutions that are going to bring about a change in our communities and in our society.
I absolutely agree. You never stop trying. You continue to go to the well, even when you think it's dry. No one is worth being discarded. And it's unfortunate. The party in charge, especially in progressive states, they seem to have. I've listened to many of the hearings in Olympia and other states. And when you remove consequences from this sort of conduct, it becomes a free-for-all. And you just look at San Francisco, just look at Seattle, just look across the spectrum of progressive-led states. And again, the proof's in the pudding. Violent crime. What can be done on the federal level? We're seeing increases across the, well, mostly in Democrat-led states again, but what can be done on the federal level to maybe inject themselves in some of these states? New York, for instance, Alvin Bragg just simply will not prosecute. Can the feds pick up the ball and maybe inject themselves somehow?
Well, and that's what I'm trying to do here. If we pass a federal law that says that drug dealers are going to get manslaughter charges, it gives the power to the local states, the local governance, to carry out the law. Even in those states that perpetuate this accepting of those things that are infringing upon the future of our own families. So this is why when I get to the United States Senate, I am going to push this very hard. And someone asked me, well, how about if someone takes it from you right now and then you won't get credit? I said, I am pushing this because I feel that we are in a situation that we need to pay attention and find solutions. If someone wants to take it from me right now and make it true, I will be the first witness in that congressional hearing in support of it. Of course. I mean, this is not about politics. This is about saving lives and having a better future for our families.
You should give me a ring when we're done here at some point, because I did run for Congress a couple of years ago, and I do have a couple of bills drafted up and ready to go, and happy to share them. And again, I don't care whose credit it is or who gets the accolades. I want the success story to come out of it, simply that. But let's pivot a little bit, because I could stay on crime and drugs all night, and I want the folks to get to know you. So new documents obtained by the Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government reveal that the feds flag terms like MAGA, Christians, Trump, pro-life, for financial institutions, using those phrases in transactions. So same manner as if you shopped at Cabela's or Dick's Sporting Goods, or even bought Bibles, your transactions were flagged. What's happening in the federal government? We see what's happening to the president on full display. He's the giant elephant in the room that says, if you don't go along, this is what could happen to you. How do we rein in these three-letter agencies at this point?
With oversight. We certainly more congressional oversight and from people that want to bring about a government that is by the people instead of the government that we are seeing as very similar to what I saw in Cuba, yep. Right? In Cuba, my uncle was put in jail because he was present at a house that they found a gun in. The owners of the house got the firing squad. He was put in jail and not given food for, I think, a couple of weeks because of that. Of course, he was a political prisoner, and he came to the United States successfully. Thankfully, has had a great life here. But these are the that is the story of a frog being placed in hot water. She would jump out immediately. But if you place a frog in lukewarm water and then heat it slowly the frog will burn and not notice. And this is what is happening in our country. Slowly, we're burning. We're burning our bridges to the opportunities of the future, to that American dream that I so much loved when I was in Cuba. Coming here was everything to me. And we're burning that light that Reagan talked about, that is the last light that we have in this world. We cannot surrender. We have to fight this. We have to set it back. We can't let our government get bigger and in control of all our lives, because that has never succeeded in history.
Which committees does Senator Garcia see himself sitting on?
Well, you know, I'll be a freshman senator, and they they will certainly...
got to have aspirations.
But my... The truth is easy. You know, I am going to sit on committees that bring about change in the state of Washington, right? I'm going to sit on committees that I feel will benefit the state of Washington. I have a fundamental belief that the larger body of government is here to make the smaller body of government succeed, and not the other way around. So Olympia should be working for our counties, and our counties should be working for our cities to succeed, instead of Olympia sending us mandates, and that's why this doesn't work, and instead of Washington, D.C. sending mandates to the country. I think that I will be here to make sure that Washington succeeds, so I will be a part of those committees that are most helpful for Washington, as the Committee on Transportation, that could actually build housing around the rail that has so much been the topic of conversation in King County. But you know what there isn't around the rail? Housing for low-income families, that the Department of Transportation could have helped with that. So that's one example, but I really would look at the committees that could benefit the state of Washington and our industries here, and of course have a say, because when you're at the table, you make sure that your people don't get the short end of the stick, and that's what I want to do as your United States Senator.
Joe Biden just canceled another $1.2 billion in student loans for a total of, I think, $132 or $136 billion. Despite the Supreme Court ruling against him, how do we stop or at least impede a reckless branch continuing to use public dollars as really bribery for young people's votes?
We need the majority. We need the majority in the Senate and in the House, and we need to overrule that. I will tell you a very sad story. When I had to file for the FEC financial disclosure for my candidacy, my wife and I went through everything we had, and you know, all our debt and so on, and she put down her student loan debt, you know, that she had, and then I went to see how much my student loan debt was, because for me it was automatic. It came out of my checking account every month. Much to my surprise, this is Dr. Garcia here that can afford to pay his own student loans, because you know, I asked for them to study. Much to my surprise, there was a note that my student loans had been paid by President Biden. And I got a chuckle out of that. I looked at my wife. I said, I never asked for this. This is not okay.
Because, you know, of your last name. I've heard this before from people with, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I've heard this before of people with Hispanic sounding last names, Asian sounding last names, that they've received the same notifications, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, I called and they said, no, I mean, it's done. You can't reverse it. That this is, this is done. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of large amount left. I had a small amount left. But nevertheless, you know, I could afford to pay the loans that I asked for. Why is the government putting their hands on this? And obviously there's someone else that actually may need it more than me. And they have a faulty system just to plant a flag and say, oh, we forgave this much, these many millions from our students. And truthfully, the universities are taking advantage of the fact that the government is subsidizing these educations and asking for $75,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year for tuition and board. It's something that we need to get a hold of, and by getting a majority, I think we will.
And so you touched on it. What are your thoughts on what's happening on the college campuses today?
Well, I would like to see tuition come down and more acceptances come up. I would also like to see, even before we get to the college campus, and I will answer your question, because you're probably asking me about the education that they're receiving and the anti-America, let's say, sentiment.
Correct.
That is being pushed in our campuses. But I want to give you a comprehensive answer. So to begin, we need to teach junior high and high school students finances, so that they don't embark on a journey in college that comes out to $300,000, and then they end up having a job that pays them $25,000 a year. You know, we need to give them all the information. As I said, this is a role of our government to educate and give resources. And for some people, you know, a tech career could last their whole life and have a great life, but they didn't know that information. So they just pushed college and college and college. And within college, we need to make sure that this abuse that is happening by our universities stops. We need to start accepting more students that really want to pursue careers and lower tuition. I'm going to try and speak to the president of the University of Washington, who happens also to be Cuban, and I have spoken to her before. We, I'm sure, differ on a lot of ideologies when it comes to politics, but I think she's a very smart individual, and would love to sit with her and get her point of view on what is happening in our colleges and this problem of universities now, their education costs being prohibitive to some families. So I will certainly pursue this. This is something that I am very interested in, and I really want to find solutions to.
All right, so I don't have a lot of time left, but I did want to ask a couple more questions, and one of them is important to me, is that I know when I ran for office, I really learned a lot about the goings-on of politics, and many members of the House and Senate leave office as multimillionaires when they weren't multimillionaires coming in there. Do you support the banning of stock trading and that sort of insider trading in the Senate and in the House? Shouldn't we be held to a higher standard?
I think that we as senators are the representative of people, and as such should have the same laws and the same obligations as the regular citizen that we're representing. So I don't think that we as senators should have any special privileges like that.
as a senator, you may be called, and of course you most likely will at some point, to vote to confirm justices to the Supreme Court and to other courts, really. What criteria or what attributes, because personally I think this is probably one of the more important roles in the Senate, and I think President Trump's appointees to the Supreme Court have really kind of staved off some of the attacks at this point. What will you seek out in these nominees?
Well, first of all, I would like to see nominees that are worthy of that office, not because of the color of their skin or their political view. Or I'd like to see people that are actually worthy of that office. And I remember back in the day when I was working for Senator Dole, I mean, we viewed the Supreme Court as this very honorable place where justices that were we knew that were very liberal and justices that were very conservative still had dinner and went out at night and were friends and were able to academically discuss the law and support the Constitution. And that for me is a must. I think that these individuals need to be scholars and love the Constitution of this country.
I got about 2 minutes left, so how about a little bit of rapid fire? Have a little bit of fun. Yes and no questions.
Okay.
Term limits.
Yes.
Do you have confidence in mail-in voting, all mail-in voting?
I would like to have a national holiday. This is something I'm going to pursue for voting in the United States, as it has been successful in many other countries.
Should ballot harvesting be legal?
No.
If you could change one aspect of American politics, what would it be? And you can elaborate. This is our last one.
The confidence that people have in the political system, and that we do through remembering that we are in service. As I said when I started this interview, my goal of service has not changed. What has changed is the venue. And I will provide service every day of my life as a U.S. Senator, and I believe that if every one of us does the same, the trust in the political system of America will change.
Well, Dr. Garcia, thank you so much for really providing a high degree of patriotism in every theater, whether it's in the operating room, the emergency room, or the legislative room. I mean, You really are. You personify the American dream. When I read your bio coming here as Cuban immigrants and needing to leave due to communism and the way you came through another country and still made it to the United States, this was your dream. And it's it makes my heart feel really good in the sense that the system does work and it can work for people that have to participate in it. What we can't have is any size fits all and anything goes. So thank you so much for all you do in and out of the operating room, in and out of the emergency room, and hopefully in and out of the Senate. How can the people get a hold of you, Doc?
Well, thank you so much. They could get a hold of me by going to garcia4wa.com. That's F-O-R-W-A.com. Certainly want everyone to not leave me alone on this, right? We are all in this. Yes, I will be your senator, but you will be a part of every decision that I make. So let's join the movement of GarciaForWa.com to bring about a true government of service. And you could reach me there. You could reach me through the website at info@GarciaForWa.com or Raul@GarciaForWa.com. But certainly, come and volunteer. because this is a movement that I think will change our state for those opportunities I had when I was 11 years old and didn't speak a word of English. I want to make sure that all our children have that and more.
Excellent. Amen, brother. That's all I can say is amen to that. All right, folks.
Thank you for your service.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. And again, that's what this show's about is people got to get to know you. I wanted to get to know you, and I think you're a home run waiting to be hit, Doc. So, again, thank you so much. Appreciate you. Appreciate your family. May God bless you. God bless your family as well.
Thank you. The same for you.
Friends, welcome back to the show. What a great guest. Very impressive individual, Dr. Garcia. I do hope to get to meet him one day, and I do hope to have him representing all of us one day. Friends, I was researching our National Archives prior to the show on an unrelated topic. And I was actually kind of surprised at what had popped up, and I was just wanted to take a quick moment and share this with you. On July 7th, 1896, the opening statement to the Democrat National Convention read as follows. We, the Democrats of the United States, in National Convention assembled, do reaffirm our allegiance to those great essential principles of justice and liberty upon which our Constitution and institutions are founded, and which the Democratic Party has advocated from Jefferson times to our own. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of conscience, the preservation of personal rights, the equality of all citizens before the law, and the faithful observance of constitutional limitations. And I bring that up just to give some context to how these folks have fallen off the cliff. All of us should be deeply concerned in the way that progressive Democrats are insulating themselves from the public and public scrutiny. They've enacted policies that strengthen their grip and weaken the electoral process. Current Democrat policy proposals would rewrite America's Constitution as we know it. The proposals such as eliminating the filibuster or additional statehood to U.S. territories, these are simply the tip of the iceberg for the constitutional revisionists. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. They want to centralize the voting rules within the federal government. They want to give all illegal immigrants U.S. citizenship, permanently altering political landscape in America. And friends, this raises a much broader question as well. What's the end game? Fortunately for America, Democrats are revealing their true colors, and Americans ought to pay close attention. The left has no interest in promoting safe streets, securing the border, financial stability for the American people. They're just words. They're just words that echo from the past. They don't care about liberty or the pursuit of happiness. They believe the government should play a massive role in your day-to-day life. And friends, that is Marxism. Mm. And they are Marxists. This is what they've become. This is what entrenched power looks like up close. So let's review the last 3 years. Because they've given us an absolutely great sample size. Over 8 million illegals have invaded our country, many of which are unaccounted for. Fentanyl is continuing to pour onto the streets and poisoning a generation. Crime in Democrat cities is off the charts and setting new records month over month. Inflation is choking the life out of the average American family. Our national debt has grown to over $34 trillion, and let me give you some quick context to that. Before we can fund one program or pay one senior their Social Security check, we must cough up $1 trillion just to service the annual debt that they've amassed. Think about that. Without swift intervention, this ends badly for all of us, and the Democrats know it. This is why a changing of the guard is abundantly necessary for America's survival. The Marxists rightfully see America as weak and vulnerable at this point, and I can't say that they're wrong. A solution must emerge now to be presided over by our next legislators, taking its bearing only from the breath of the current failures. Friends, that's it for today's show. I really hope you enjoyed Dr. Garcia. The story of migrating from communist Cuba is again, it's what America's about. Take the time to research them. Check them out. Once again, I want to thank Dr. Garcia for taking the time from his busy medical practice, as well as the campaign trail to join us today, and really thank him for being a true servant of the people. Kudos to him for wanting to make a difference. Also, thanks Steve, the producer, for all the work he does behind the microphone getting us on the air. And I also invite you to tune in next week, next Wednesday, the 28th, as we welcome conservative radio talk show host extraordinaire, Kirby Wilbur. Looking forward to talking to him, too. Lastly, I want to thank you, the Mill Creek View audience, for listening. It's no easy trick bringing you the truth in today's America, but we will always endeavor to do so. So until next time, I'm Mill Creek City Councilman, and I wish you all, Vincent Cavalieri, and I wish you all God's peace. Take us home, Steve.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.